From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, we'll bring you a pair of important panel conversations touching on civil rights, history, and race relations. Later in this hour, you'll hear from three former LAPD officers who are fighting against the systemic racism that they and many others say pervades the nation's law enforcement agencies. But first, after the shooting massacre of nine people at an historic black church in Charleston, South Carolina in June, there was heated conversation over the meaning of the Confederate flag. The issue showed that the causes and effects of the Civil War linger to this very day. And so today, we're rebroadcasting a special panel conversation held earlier this year to mark the 150th anniversary of the war's end. Pleased to welcome Dinah Ramey Berry, Associate Professor of History and African Diaspora Studies at the University of Texas at Austin, Eric Walther, Professor of U.S. History at the University of Houston, and Allison Hobbs, Assistant Professor of American History at Stanford University. I have read countless times, I guess, in my life, Howard Zinn's wonderful book, A People's History of the United States. I'm sure you have all read that. Mm-hmm. There's a quote that Zinn has in this book. I suspect there'll be those who will disagree with it. Yeah. This is from Howard Zinn's book. John Brown was executed by the state of Virginia with the approval of the national government. It was the national government which sternly enforced the laws providing for the return of fugitives to slavery. It was the national government that collaborated with the South to keep abolitionist literature out of the mails in the southern states. It was the Supreme Court of the United States that declared that the slave Dred Scott could not sue for his freedom because he was not a person but property. Such a national government would never accept an end to slavery by rebellion. It would end slavery only under conditions controlled by whites and only when required by the political and economic needs of the business elite of the North. It was Abraham Lincoln who combined perfectly the needs of business, the political ambition of the new Republican Party, and the rhetoric of humanitarianism. That's what Zinn had to say about the Civil War, which leads me to start our conversation, Professor Hobbs, by asking whether or not the Civil War, to your mind, was fought over the ethics of slavery, as we've all been taught in school, whether or not this was really about economics. Not ethics, but economics.
Mm-hmm. It's a great question. I mean, the quote is really a fascinating quote. Mm-hmm. And just to say a couple things about the quote, it's what I find so interesting about it is the way that Zinn is explaining to us the role of the national government, mm-hmm. and how the national government is playing such a major, a critical role in supporting slavery and in protecting slave owners' property. Mm-hmm. Because regardless, we know that enslaved people were human beings, mm-hmm. but of course, to Southern slaveholders, they were billions and billions of dollars of property. And so when the Civil War came, this was an incredible threat to a whole way of life, mm-hmm. To millions of dollars. A lot of historians have argued that Southerners didn't invest in other forms of infrastructure like railroads or like manufacturing because they had so much money tied up mm-hmm. in slavery. So I think that I would say that it's both, mm-hmm. that it's both about economics, but I think that the morality and the issue around slavery and slavery as a system mm-hmm. of human chattel cannot be ignored, and that we've spent a lot of time sort of looking away from right. the issue of slavery because we are so kind of scared to talk about mm-hmm. race and to really face those issues around slavery and race, but it seems like to really get a broader understanding of why the Civil War was actually fought, we really need yeah. to bring the issue of slavery into the conversation.
Professor Berry, ethics, economics, neither or both?
Well, I would argue it's a combination of all because mm-hmm. slavery is an economic institution. Mm-hmm. And so I think that when people don't want to deal with slavery, they'll say it was economics, but the primary institution that the Southern economy was based upon was slavery. When you look at the numbers, when we look at the actual dollar values, in 1805, there were about 1 million enslaved people in the United States, worth $300 million. And on the eve of the Civil War, about 50 years later, it was about 4 million African Americans that were enslaved, worth $3 billion. That's a mm-hmm. lot of money. Mm-hmm. And that's a large growth over time. So there are economics involved in this, but the economy was the body of enslaved people.
Yeah.
And just to build on that point, the fact that by the eve of the Civil War, that slavery accounted for 70% mm-hmm. of the United States GDP.
Right.
So it really gives us a sense yeah. of just how what a large percentage it accounted for.
Professor Walther, I wonder what your take is on Abraham Lincoln, where this particular anniversary is concerned. There are any number of narratives that one could write about the role that Lincoln played or didn't play, what he did do, what he didn't do. He started out on the wrong side of the slavery question. Took him a while to get on the right side. Mm-hmm. So what's your sense of, what's your Lincoln narrative 150 years later?
I find him quite admirable. Mm-hmm. Because, and I guess it goes hand in hand with being a college teacher and wanting to see people improve, mm-hmm. he improved. Mm-hmm. He knew he was a racist. He admitted it freely. I mean, not bragging about it. Mm-hmm. He admitted it and was a racist. Did not believe that black people were white people's equal on the eve of the Civil War. Mm-hmm. But various events changed him. The war itself, matter of fact, if you'll allow me to quote, I came across a quotation that fits so many occasions but definitely pertains to Abraham Lincoln, mm-hmm. and that is, "We come to know who we really are in the darkest and most difficult days of our lives." Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah, it was Tavis Smiley on The Daily Show September 11th last year.
I remember
but,
that.
But, yeah, but that is right, and Lincoln grew and probably came really close to completely purging his mind and heart and soul about racism.
And one could argue, I think legitimately, that as much progress as has been made 150 years later, these are still dark and desolate, right. dreary days. I say that because 150 years later, when you're still fighting about citizenship mm-hmm. and about rights exactly. and about democracy, mm-hmm. what does that say about where we are 150 years later?
We have not been free as long as we were enslaved. African Americans have mm-hmm. not been free as long as we've been enslaved. And so when you think about that on a temporal perspective, mm-hmm. it makes sense that we're still struggling and trying to find ways to interact with all groups of people. Mm-hmm. You have slavery lasting about 246 years, depending on when you date it. Mm-hmm. And then you look at how long we've been free. We've been free since 1865. And the Reconstruction era was short-lived. We tried to find ways as a country to heal ourselves from slavery, but there was 700,000 lives lost in this war. Parts of the South were completely devastated or destroyed, and you had a complete economic destruction of the South. So you have to rebuild from there, and the race relations were very tight after that. You have tensions that kept going even until today when we look at some of the Black Lives Matter movement. So I would argue we're still trying to figure it out. We're mm-hmm. a nation that has not really liked to talk about race, mm-hmm. and we're now at a point where we talk about it when we have to.
Professor Hobbs, I wonder your sense of the argument that we hear all the time, certainly mm-hmm. African Americans all the time, that when it comes to race, we ought to just get over it, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about that in preparation for our conversation because, to your point, Professor Berry, we have not been free as long as we were enslaved, number one. Number two, the last soldier to die who fought in the Civil War just died in 1959. And further, we're just now celebrating 50 years since the Civil Rights Act and 50 years since the Voting Rights Act. I am 50 years old.
Right.
And we're just now celebrating 50 years since the Voting Rights Act, basically 50 years since the Civil Rights Act. And I wonder whether or not people don't really have a proper
absolutely.
Perspective
absolutely.
On how near to slavery we still
absolutely.
Are.
That's absolutely right. I think that, one, there is a kind of disconnection that people have with our history mm-hmm. generally. And I really was moved watching 12 Years a Slave. Mm-hmm. And in the very beginning, there's a scene where Solomon Northrop is on a boat and there's a man who's sitting next to him who's also enslaved. Mm-hmm. And there's a horrible act of violence that occurs where another enslaved person is stabbed brutally. And Solomon Northrop kind of jumps and the man sitting next to him says, "You have to look away. That's the only way you can survive." Mm-hmm. And it seems like throughout that film, there are these reminders of, in order to be able to survive this, you have to look away. You can't look at it straight on because it's too devastating. It's too traumatizing. Mm-hmm. And I almost feel like that's the way that Americans have been socialized to think and to understand or not to understand issues of race, that we look away, we turn away, and that seems to kind of create even more distance between us and our history, mm-hmm. that it is so much closer and it's so much more connected to our present day than I think a lot of people yeah. realize. So, for example, you know, the 14th Amendment passed in 1868, mm-hmm. which along with the Civil Rights Act of 1866 was what codified birthright citizenship. So meaning if you're born in the United mm-hmm. States, you are a citizen. I don't know if that could pass today. Mm-hmm. And that's really terrifying to think about, that if we think about these current issues that our country is going through when it comes to immigration, that perhaps we couldn't even pass a law today that we passed in 1868.
Yeah.
So I feel like that history is much closer to us than we know,
yeah.
And I feel like it's much closer to us than we want to see.
First of all, as you teach this stuff every day, what misconceptions, I know there are many, but is there a particular misconception about this anniversary 150 years later that most concerns you, that you tell your students all the time, if there's one thing that I need to set the record straight about, it's this?
In a nutshell, it was all about slavery.
Right.
Not in the economics of it. Also, for white Southerners, it was their sense of esteem and honor was to be literally the master class, the ruling race, as Jim Oakes wrote about many decades ago. And again, that you go from the horrors of slavery from 1619 to 1865, you go through the terror of Reconstruction that really was, on to lynching later in the 19th and early 20th century, and on and on and on and on. And I remember, well, right after the Supreme Court last year gutted the Voting Rights Act, I don't remember who the guest was on MSNBC, but it was a young African-American man, and he was just looking at the person who was doing the interview, and all he could say was like, it's been 400 years, and just stopped like this. And that was it. It's like, how many more fights for all people are created equal, for the Constitution, for Southern conservatism and rule of law? I can't really imagine that.
What lie most grates on you, Professor Berry?
That Lincoln's the great emancipator. I'm probably the outlier on this panel here, because my students feel like Lincoln freed all African Americans. And so I have to clarify that the 1863 Emancipation Proclamation freed slaves in the state of rebellion. Those were those in the Confederacy, but those that lived in those states did not believe Lincoln was their president. So there was this notion of Lincoln as being this great liberator. African Americans in the 1930s and 40s, when they were interviewed as the last living descendants of former slaves, they had photographs of Lincoln on their wall. That's an attitude about Lincoln that's prevailed, I would say. So I talked to the students about the nuances, about how he's changed over time, and about how he's not the sole person that liberated African Americans, and that African Americans fought for liberation from the moment they were captured at every single stage of enslavement, and even beyond in freedom.
Which was another issue I want to come back to after you get a chance to sound off on the thing that most disturbs you. I want to come back to this notion of self-liberation and the role that black folk themselves have played, not like somebody was just being nice.
Exactly.
Yeah, but we'll come back to that. But what most disturbs you?
That would absolutely, I would definitely agree with that. That what I try to teach my students is that African American history is, of course, deeply a part of American history, and that the African American freedom struggle is so much longer and so much wider and deeper than I think we sort of understand. That we often think about these moments, and we don't sort of see this longer struggle. We don't see the idea that in the Middle Passage there were acts of resistance and rebellion, that then those acts of resistance and rebellion continued in small towns and on plantations and on farms, and then it was really the slaves that freed themselves by running to the Union Army and by creating the conditions that forced the federal government to have to take measures to eventually pass or to eventually write the Emancipation Proclamation, for Lincoln to eventually write the Emancipation Proclamation. And then that during Reconstruction and during all these other turning points that we think about in American history, that there's always some resistance that's going on among African Americans. To think about the Great Migration as a part of the freedom struggle. So the freedom struggle is not, of course, the Civil Rights Revolution is an incredible watershed moment, but to sort of look at it in the context of this much longer history of rebellion and revolution.
How do we think of the period of Reconstruction that followed all these years later?
It was too short.
You
can't heal a nation that quickly.
Yeah.
You also have the Freedmen Bureau workers coming into the South trying to help negotiate labor contracts, and whites that did not want to pay blacks for their labor. not willing to deal with the social situation that was the result in the aftermath of the Civil War. So I would say that it was short-lived, and it was in a being blunt, it was unsuccessful.
I think Reconstruction for me is an incredibly rich period to teach. Mm-hmm. And I think it actually goes back to your previous question that it's another moment that is also very misunderstood mm-hmm. and sort of undertaught. And I think that the key, one of the really fascinating pieces about Reconstruction is that it's this moment of incredible hopefulness mm-hmm. and incredible optimism. There's this sense that who knows what could happen? This is a new world. There's been a revolution. You know, people change their names. They change their names to things like Deliverance Begin, and, mm-hmm. you know, they change their last names to Freedman. And, mm-hmm. you know, so it's this moment of incredible expectation and anticipation. And I completely agree that the tragedy of it is that it's short-lived, that it turns into, well, actually, it begins with just explosive violence, which mm-hmm. continues throughout the period. The federal government does not do enough to protect former slaves and freed people. But also, I think the real problem is that the federal government doesn't offer land. Mm-hmm. That if freed people had land, that could have really changed everything. And there's a quote that I would love to read. Sure. It's very brief, but it's a freedman named Bailey Watts, and he's at a political meeting, which would then turn into the Union League mm-hmm. meetings that occurred throughout the South during Reconstruction. And he's in Yorktown, Virginia, and he speaks very powerfully about economics, but also about land and about the relationship between land and freedom. And he says, "May I state to all of our friends and our enemies that we has a right to the land where we are located. Why? I'll tell you. Our wives, our children, our husbands has been sold over and over again to purchase the lands we now locates upon. For that reason, we have a divine right mm-hmm. to the land. And then didn't we clear the lands and raise the crops of corn and of cotton and of tobacco and of rice and of sugar and of everything? And then didn't them large cities in the north grow up on the cotton and the sugars and the rice that we made? I see that they have grown rich, yet my people are poor." Mm-hmm. So this really beautifully poignant, powerful message from a man who likely had not had formal schooling, had not taken an economics class, had not taken a political philosophy class, but yet understands these very complicated mm-hmm. concepts about the labor theory of value and about the necessity of land. And without land, could African Americans truly be free?
Mm-hmm. That's a powerful quote. I want to ask a question that is unapologetically loaded, but I'm curious as to what might come from this question, and that is, any parallels you would draw between the politics of then and the politics you see being practiced mm-hmm. in Washington today? And I don't want to color the question any more than that deliberately.
So, for me, I think about Congress and yeah. about some of the issues that President Obama has had with getting Congress to move on topics that he was trying to get them to move on. Mm-hmm. You see some of those challenges with Lincoln and even within the Emancipation Proclamation and even dealing with issues of colonization. Mm-hmm. So I think that Congress can sort of tie things up, and we're seeing some of those same tactics today.
Yeah. Well, and actually, during the Civil War, one of the problems, one of the many obstacles Lincoln had that his adversaries didn't really have to deal with mm-hmm. was a vigorous two-party system in the North during the Civil mm-hmm. War. Mm-hmm. You had politicians demanding and getting generals named by their political party. Mm-hmm. I mean, George McClellan was thrust on Lincoln. That was not Lincoln's choice, mm-hmm. but he knew he had to stick with McClellan to keep the Democratic Unionists.
Professor Hobbs, any parallels you draw between the politics then and the politics we see being practiced today?
That's a great question. I mean, I think that one thing that I wish we had more of today is that Lincoln, I think, I agree that he evolved, and I agree that there was this sort of transformation in his thinking. But I also think that part of what happened was that he had a lot of people really putting a lot of pressure on him.
Oh, yeah.
He had abolitionists. You know, he had William Lloyd Garrison, who immediately says, you know, you're not doing enough. You've got to go farther. This isn't strong enough. Even the Emancipation Proclamation, you know, it's not strong enough. We have to move farther. He also had a number of senators and congressmen, like, you know, someone like Salmon Chase, someone mm-hmm. like Trumbull. So there really was a lot of pressure and a lot of sort of support that Lincoln had to kind of push him farther. And I sort of wish that we were moving further mm-hmm. to the left today, yeah. you know, and that there was more pressure to push us further to the left.
I'll start with you, Professor Berry. If there is a particular takeaway that the American people ought to focus on 150 years later, what do you want us to consider?
I think we need to talk about race. We need to talk about slavery.
Still.
Yes, yeah. I do. I don't think we're done. Mm-hmm. I think we need to understand the ramifications of slavery and the wealth that was generated from slavery mm-hmm. and what that means and why there's such a large economic disparity today. Yeah. I think that's the main takeaway for me. But I'm a scholar of slavery, so yeah. I'm going to say that.
No, I accept that.
Yeah.
Professor Walther?
That slavery still matters, that the Civil War still matters, that, as you said at the beginning, this you take all of the battle death from the American Revolution, War of 1812, Mexican War, Indian Wars of the 19th century, on and on and on, right through World War I, World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, and it's still a little bit under all of the deaths from the Civil War combined.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we've actually just broken through that by a few thousand over in just recently, within the last few years. And that matters. That's and the scars from that are still there. From the Reconstruction era, we have a lot of these, a lot of southern states and other Midwestern states just kind of ignoring the Constitution, yeah. not kind of, literally doing it, challenging Supreme Court decisions right now. Mm-hmm. The controversy in Indiana, it's about yeah. bigotry.
Professor Hobbs, take away for you.
Just very quickly, I would say that I think that it's very important for us to know our history mm-hmm. and that history allows us to understand our past. It allows us to understand our present, and it also allows us to imagine a different kind of future. And I think that in those dark hours, that history for me becomes very kind of healing in mm-hmm. a sense, because I see the possibility of something different. And that's why I think the Reconstruction era, while it didn't go far enough and it didn't last long enough, it still offers us this sense of the possibility of something different. Mm-hmm. So I guess I would say that I think that we need to know our history, and we need to sort of immerse ourselves in our history so that we can see that history is not linear, that mm-hmm. that it's never a story of, you know, slavery to freedom, slavery to Obama, mm-hmm. that there are always these fits and starts. There are always these moments of devastation, and then there are these moments of hopefulness and optimism. Mm-hmm. And I think that can sort of keep our spirits kind of buoyed when we do face these moments that are difficult and
so
challenging.
Wonderful conversation, never long enough, but thank you all for coming on and expressing your insights 150 years after the end of the Civil War. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. With the recent flood of videos surfacing from all over the country of violence against unarmed black men, women, and children at the hands of police, we're taking this opportunity to examine the extent of institutional racism in police departments and whether police culture perpetuates the problem. We've convened today a panel of three retired LAPD officers to discuss the issue. All of them are now devoting their time to seeking solutions to the systemic problems that many feel have permeated police departments across the nation. Our panelists are Sergeant Cheryl Dorsey, a 20-year LAPD veteran whose assignments included vice, narcotics, patrol, and the controversial gang unit called Crash. She's currently a community advocate and police expert and the author of an autobiography about her experiences on the police force titled Black and Blue, The Creation of a Manifesto.
Captain John Mutz, a 25-year veteran now working as an executive coach. He helped develop a mediation program for racial profiling cases for the LAPD and supports training officers with skills to foster more effective decision-making in high-stress situations. And finally, Officer Alex Salazar spent 9 years with the LAPD. He was assigned to the notorious Rampart Division, which served as the basis for the film Training Day, starring one Denzel Washington. Now works as a private investigator focusing on civil rights and police abuse cases. And I am honored to have you all on this program. Mr. Mutz, let me start with you and ask point blank whether or not Americans should be afraid of their police departments, because you get that sentiment from a lot of fellow citizens these days. They're just afraid of cops.
You know, I think most Americans, when watching the television and the media coverage, will have quite a range. And certainly people of color, would be very concerned about what's happened. And, you know, many people in diverse communities have had bad experiences with the police. And, and there have been some good experiences as well. But it runs deep.
Mm. How deep?
You know, I think there's 18,000 state and local law enforcement agencies in the country. Mm-hmm. And they're all so different. And they're individually governed. And the question is, I think, is to really have the inquiry in your particular setting, your city, your county, your neighborhood, as to what is the relationship with the police and, what are the concerns and what's not working. And begin to say that these kinds of decisions have to be in the hands of the community. Mm-hmm. The police are serving the community. And it's really more about how do we get closer to that and acknowledge that that's the relationship, one of being served. Mm-hmm.
I wonder whether or not, though, sure, you think most cops are comfortable with having their careers placed in the hands of citizen review boards. I mean, one of the things that, you know, those of us who care about this you've been calling for is across the board, police departments in every city in this country need to be overseen by civilian review boards. But I get the sense that inside of or behind that blue wall, that most people behind that wall aren't altogether fans of these citizen review panels.
Well, you know, a citizen review panel only has so much power, mm-hmm. right? And so we understand that most of what they do is a recommendation to the chief of police. Because here in Los Angeles, our chief of police is the ultimate decider in terms of discipline. We have a recent situation with Ezell Ford here, a young mentally mm-hmm. ill man who was killed by the police. And they're at odds right now. The police chief feels that the use of force, the deadly force, was accessible, acceptable. Mm-hmm. The police commission has problems with it. And so while they have a problem with it, he's under no obligation to be guided by their recommendation. And he can very easily make the minimal decision in terms of discipline, which would be training. I'll just give mm-hmm. these guys training. And so officers understand that if they have his support, and that's what he's saying recently, you have my support, mm-hmm. code talk for, there won't be much discipline meted out. And so unless and until there's a police commission, number one, who's not beholden to the person that appoints them, like our mayor, mm-hmm. right? If you serve at the pleasure of the mayor, you do his bidding. Mm-hmm. So are they really independent? We need someone who is truly independent, whose recommendations actually have teeth and are maybe binding. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, what they say and feel is anecdotal, right?
Every city is different, as John Mutz said a moment ago, but I wonder whether or not it is your belief that police chiefs across the board have too much power.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And what I say is that the problems that we're seeing are top down. Mm-hmm. It's the police chief on down. When you look at the problems that they're having in Baltimore with Commissioner Batts, right? He's a three-time head of a police department, first here in mm-hmm. Long Beach, then in Oakland, and now in Baltimore. And trouble seems to follow him wherever he goes. And so unless and until police chiefs and commissioners and sheriffs admit mm-hmm. that there's a problem on their department, there's really nothing to fix.
Speaking of chiefs who have served in different cities, Mr. Bratton now in New York City,
was at one point, of course, the chief of police here in Los Angeles, made some news the other day, I'm sure you all saw, when he suggested that it's hard to find black and brown cops these days because so many of them have records, not just misdemeanors, but felonies on their records. And, of course, you can't be a cop if you have a felony. I don't know if you heard that comment, but what's your sense of the difficulty in finding high-quality black and brown cops to serve these days? And I ask that for the obvious reason that perhaps if people looked more like us who are policing our communities, these problems wouldn't exist. But, again, full circle, if you can't get good black and brown cops because too many have records, what does that leave you?
Well, you know, I don't buy into that, first of all. And what does that outreach look like? What does that recruitment look like, right? And then what about those officers who are putting people in the system? Because we know that that goes on. We know that officers generate probable cause and reasonable suspicion to stop you. And then they put you in the system. They give you a number. And it doesn't matter if it doesn't stick, if there's no real reason to hold you, because now you're in the system, right? And so why don't we tackle that? Why don't we stop creating reasons to put these black and brown men in the system and thereby making them ineligible for those kinds of positions?
I mentioned Alex Salazar earlier in this conversation, at the introduction for that matter, that you worked in Rampart Division. We all saw the movie Training Day. Denzel won an Academy Award for that, Denzel Washington, for playing that character. It occurs to me that when people see citizens see films like that, and see the kind of TV shows that are everywhere, prevalent these days, this stuff doesn't come out of the ether. I mean, these stories are based on some truth somewhere. Right. Stephen Colbert back in the day called it truthiness, but it's based on some sort of truth. To what extent is what we are seeing based upon reality?
Well, a lot of it is real, unfortunately. Yeah. I did work in that environment. I saw a lot of this corruption. I participated in some of this corruption. I'm not proud to say it, but in attacking the system for what it is, we need to be not ashamed anymore. We need to bring these things out because there is a culture of what they call the code of silence. We're dealing with an insular culture which is secret, which denies that there's a problem that in fact exists. Yet, as you mentioned, there's all these locations that are now household names, Baltimore, Ferguson, Los Angeles. I mean, there's just so much going on that we've never actually dealt with it before. Now it's all come out to the surface. Of course, we had the shooting in Charleston, all because of race, you know, and this is what has divided us for the longest. And until we have this real talk like what we're doing right now, we're never going to get beyond this. Right now, as we speak, there's white people, there's Latinos and blacks that we're talking about this. It just makes them really mad. In fact, it was this type of hatred and demonization that was caused upon Dr. King, you know, when he was taken out for discussing this type of subject matter. So we need to continue doing that. And yes, it still continues on as we speak.
John Mutz, I wonder how much some of this has to do with a mentality, a militarized mentality inside of our police departments. I don't want to lay this wholly at the feet of those who have served in our military, but I think of Tamir Rice, the young 12-year-old kid shot within 2 seconds of a cop getting out of a car in the city of Cleveland. That cop had served in the military. He's not the only cop who had previously served in the military who finds himself in trouble when they come back to join a police force. And there are many who believe that it is that mentality, that militarized mentality, that's his frame of mind when he steps out of that car and shoots this 12-year-old kid in the city of Cleveland. That case or beyond, your sense of whether or not there is a mentality of militarization that has crept into our police force that we're going to have to deal with at some point.
Yeah, I think that's been the trend. You know, it seems today that we have a choice of an officer being a guardian of the community, one who protects, empowers people, resolves situations, those kinds of things. So that's a different officer, and I think that's what we're calling for. The officer who has the warrior mentality is an officer who is not connected. He's biased. I'm saying he because most of them are males.
Sure.
And he really has been disconnected from his oath of office. So I think that's happened. The other thing I think that directly impacts that is we know that women in law enforcement are an asset. Mm-hmm. They tend to de-escalate situations better. They can create more of a probability of trust with someone. And yet, we don't have those numbers in law enforcement. Mm-hmm. So that's a huge area, and I think that just in itself could begin to alter that trend.
I want to share, as the woman on this panel, whether or not you think there is a trend or there will be a trend of more women becoming police officers. And I ask that in part because we do see that trend of women becoming soldiers. Indeed, now we have women who are fighting in combat as soldiers. I wonder whether or not you think, to John's point, that that would be helpful, number one, and whether or not you see that trend line moving in that direction.
I don't personally see it moving in that direction, and mm-hmm. I think it would be helpful because, understand, as a female, I know my limitations, mm-hmm. right? And I don't take things personal.
Right.
I know that I can't beat you up.
Right.
And so I've got to use other tools and techniques to gain compliance. Right. For me, what I see as a bigger problem is I see officers who are drunk with power. Mm-hmm. I see officers who are allowed to get away with indiscretions over and over again. I see no accountability. And when you look at everything that's happened nationally from Tamir Rice with Officer Lohman, mm-hmm. who came from another police department, right? Darren Wilson in Ferguson, who came from a police department, was fired from a police department. Eric Case Bolt, the man that was involved in the McKinney incident at the pool party, mm-hmm. right? He had been a Texas state trooper and an Oklahoma City police officer before he came to McKinney. Police officers don't change police departments athletes.
Why are they being recycled then?
Well, here's the deal. Because they can, right? Yeah. And so I think what should happen when an officer is found guilty of misconduct that winds up with serious bodily injury or death, they should not be given the gift of resignation. Mm-hmm. They should be fired. They should be terminated. So there's a paper trail. So we know that this guy was a bad doer on another agency. Case Bolt could very easily go and be working somewhere today. Yeah. And so this is what happens over and over. Officers are allowed to move around like chess pieces. There's no accountability, and there's no consequence for their choices.
Speaking of accountability and consequence, Cheryl, there are a number of persons who are starting to feel that if, in fact, we held these cops accountable for their acts, that is to say, held them financially accountable, not just legally accountable, but financially accountable as well. There are cops who do certain things, and they know that the city's going to pay it off.
Absolutely.
They know that it's not coming out of their pockets. But if you attach this misbehavior when the city settles and garnish their checks in part for what the city has to pay out, that might change behavior as well. Does that make sense, or is that putting too much on the officer?
I'm an advocate of it. I said all along that if officers had to shoulder some of that responsibility, that this stuff would stop yesterday. Because otherwise, if they can hide under a police department, then okay, so you give me a few days off without pay. Most police officers go get an off-duty job because
right.
we all know somebody who has a security business, right?
Right, right?
So okay, you give me a few days off without pay, and then I come back to work and it's business as usual. The city handled that $1.4 million, that $1.7. It's all good. Mm-hmm. But if I had to pay just a portion of that, I'd think twice, and I'm sure others would.
Alex, I wonder whether my mind goes back. Let me start here. My mind goes back to the O.J. Simpson case, and God knows I don't want to talk about that again.
Mm-hmm.
But I go back to that only because I remember when Christopher Darden, the prosecutor, there was this phrase that was created called the Darden Dilemma. And the Darden Dilemma essentially meant the quagmire, the conundrum that black prosecutors find themselves in when they have to prosecute black people. It's that Darden Dilemma. I'm a black prosecutor. I love my people, but part of my job means having to prosecute these Negroes when they misbehave. I wonder whether cops, black and brown cops, feel the same way. I mean, we talk about Cheryl's book is called Black and Blue. It could be brown and blue. And I want to ask you first and then Cheryl whether or not that you start to feel in the environment today, in the culture today, push back even from your own people, your own black and brown, because they are just sick and tired of the way police departments misbehave. You look at Baltimore, some of these cops that are on trial or about to be on trial now are black cops. So it's not just the white cops who are oftentimes are maltreating fellow citizens. It's black and brown as well.
Yes, well, most definitely. I know I had that issue with mm-hmm. identity, especially once you go through the military academy or the police academy. You're stripped down,
mm-hmm.
and you're not now taught the police way that you're going to have your partner's back and everything. And in some cases, you can even begin to hate your own people. I know that I saw that with myself after I was attacked, robbed, mm-hmm. and beaten up by several Latino gangbangers. Mm-hmm. I became very angry.
Mm-hmm.
And so it took me a while to admit that. I didn't see it at the time when I was a police officer because I'm here with my people, my so-called family, and we have each other's backs, and so definitely it can affect the minds of anybody.
Cheryl?
I think it's a very individual situation. For me, it's very different. First of all, I'm a female, and I'm a mother. I have four sons. And so my thing was always to treat people with dignity and compassion. I would treat anyone that I encountered the way I would want you to treat any one of my sons if you encountered them. Mm-hmm. And by and large, most of the officers, the black officers that I worked with, particularly when I was working South Bureau Crash, the gang detail, you know, we treated people the way we would want people to treat our family members. And I could look at those gangsters and think, that could be my brother, that could be my son. Mm-hmm. And so I talk to you in a way where I'm going to do my job, and if I have to take you to jail, I'm going to take you to jail, but I'm going to let you have your dignity when you go. Mm-hmm. And so there's a fine line, there's a way to do it, right?
Yeah. I wonder, John, whether it in fact is the case, it's been documented, but to what extent we have cops dealing with PTSD in the same way that former military military vets have to deal with PTSD when they come home.
Yeah, you know, that's a area I'm very interested in, and honestly, we don't know. What we do know, that it is an extremely stressful job. Officers are exposed to horrific kinds of things, and it appears that they don't do well in processing that. Mm-hmm. And over time, that changes them. We hire these fresh faces that come into law enforcement that are idealistic, wanting to serve, wanting to contribute. And then once they get into the system, something happens to them. And it may be that it's PTSD. You know, we don't know, and we've got to know a lot more about that, because I think we're just, you know, bringing people into the system and we're not supporting them. Mm. You know?
There are two or three things that have been on the docket for a long time, vis-a-vis solutions to the racism institutionalized in these police departments. So this is nothing new, but I want to throw them out now to get your take on them in no particular order. Number one, training. How much of this has to do with training?
For me, I think it has very little to do with training, because officers understand what's allowed and what's not. And what I say is, here in Los Angeles, we have two police departments. We have one south of the Santa Monica Freeway, and we have one north. And you know what I'm talking about in the more affluent areas.
Like, a lot of cities, not just L.A., have that same problem.
Right.
On one side of town, they police one way.
Right.
Other side of town, police. Okay, got it.
Right. And so officers understand how far to push the button, right, depending on where they are. Mm-hmm. And so training has very little to do with it. And again, if there's no consequence for that choice, right? And the other thing that I think is important, because we don't know to what extent PTSD plays a part, is I think officers should be reevaluated psychologically on a regular basis, because we are evaluated initially when we come on, and then that's it. And there's a stigma attached to saying, hey, I need help. And so officers are not going to ask for it. So I think police departments should do that routinely.
Training, Alex?
No, I'm not saying it's a training thing. I would say it's a cultural thing here, because the police don't ever want to admit when they're wrong. And I myself, I developed PTSD, severe PTSD, where I took out a lot of my anger on my loved ones. When I went home, I started drinking. I had all kinds of issues. And then, of course, when I came to work, you know, I would snap sometimes. Mm-hmm. And that's where you get that heavy-handed, angry officer who is a human being with mental issues, and you got these kind of demons out there that are out there also developing racist, you know, outlooks, bigoted outlooks, and that's what you know causes these crazy inflammatory situations where you have a cop that is sick with PTSD, and then he also has racism issues.
Another issue on the docket for quite some time. Some cities have actually moved to do this; others have not. Maybe more should. John Mutz, and that is, having officers live in the communities where they serve, so that they are invested in those communities.
Yeah, I think that's I think that is raises our probability of service and connection to the community. Mm-hmm. What we do know is it's dangerous to have an officer who is disconnected, lacks cultural sensitivity, probably is in his or her 20s. So we've got to attend to that. Yes, I think today we're calling for officers to be connected to their communities. And if they can't, the job's not for them.
Yeah. Cheryl, what do you say to those people who can't make the distinction between this notion that some advance, that black folk in particular are anti-police versus anti-police abuse?
Well, you know, I mean, clearly, there's a segment out there who's anti-police, right? Because we're seeing, much like the news will show you that small minority of black people who are misbehaving, and therefore others think that that's all black people. And so when you see a small minority of police officers, and I believe that to be true, who are misbehaving, people think that that's police everywhere. And I know that it's not, and my panel mates know that it's not. And so I think there has to be a concerted effort made by police departments. You know, community-based policing is a great way to do that, to get out there and engage and interact with people and let them see that I'm just a regular person who just puts on a uniform.
So training may not be the end-all, be-all, but I am curious as to how much training, how much officers get vis-a-vis mediation. Because it seems to me that so many of these incidents that we have seen on the news of late that have led to the deaths of people are situations where anybody with a different approach could have mediated their way out. Eric Garner, for selling cigarettes, did not need to be dead.
That's right.
Tamir Rice, a 12-year-old kid with a play gun, did not need to be dead. It seems to me that some of these situations require mediation. And again, I'm not saying anything that anybody in black America hasn't already heard. Look at how, you know, Dylan Roof got treated by the cops in Charleston, South Carolina, in North Carolina.
Yeah.
You know, they come, son, step out of the car. I know you got to go. Step out. I mean, look at how he gets treated versus how Eric Garner or Michael Brown. And so there are black folk, you know, in communities of color talking about this all day long. They can clearly see on camera the distinctly different ways that people are treated. But I come back to my question about whether or not some of this stuff could just be diluted if there were more mediation.
Well, listen, for me, it's common sense, right? And if sense were common, everybody would have it.
Right.
You can't teach it.
Right.
And so understand that everybody who wants to be the police shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. And so when
But why aren't we catching them in these psychological profiles coming in?
Listen, they know. Yeah. I believe that police chiefs know. Listen, Michael Schlager, the man that killed Walter Scott in North Carolina, that was the third time that he had tased someone. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like the police chief didn't know that he had an errant officer. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like the police chief in Cleveland didn't know that Tim Lohman was substandard, and they brought him on the force anyway. So it's not like they don't know. We hear about this stuff when it gets most outrageous and it ends up in a death.
But somebody
you look
knew
in
early
the history,
on, though,
there was always a red flag or always something that led to that.
Alex?
Well, you know, again, it's that mindset that's perpetuated upon the young officer. You know, they almost become cyborgs. They're not able to think for themselves. And so we know that that's, again, not the whole segment of police officers out there, but there's this mindset that they can act like cowboys. They live by mantras like better be tried by 12 than to be carried by 6. Mm-hmm. And they're not afraid. It's very arrogant. I mean, but that's the white supremacist mindset. And that's what we're dealing with many of these police departments where we're now learning that there's a large KKK infiltration within these departments that, you know, of course, these people don't care for blacks or minorities.
So much more to talk about. We just scratched the surface, but we will continue to have this conversation as time warrants. We thank Alex Salazar and John Mutz and Cheryl Dorsey. Thank you all for being on the program. Thank you for the work that you're doing ongoing. Good to have you on the program.
Thank you.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Tony Marcano is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.